You'll just have to believe me when I tell you that Friendly Fire is on the up and up when we say these are randomized movie selections. Two sci-fi movies in a row? Really? Affirmative. Did I protest these films being added to the list as not being war movies by any definition? Roger that. Was I ignored by my co-hosts as they flooded the initial list with every movie they could think of from the 80s and 90s where the main character wore a sweat-drenched and shredded tank top and half their dialogue was quips? Yes again. Let's go back to this period, the late 80s, when I was in college. Adam was running around the fountain of some mall food court somewhere yelling, "Catch me, catch me!" And Ben's parents were in Berkeley marching in favor of the Sandinistas and debating whether having children was good for the environment. Hollywood was under 4 feet of savings and loan cocaine, and action films had gotten really, really big. The United Arab Emirates built an airline just on the proceeds from the gasoline they sold Stallone for that scene in Rambo 2 where the helicopter drops a 50-gallon drum on a waterfall and triggers a 10-minute-long cascading series of napalm fireballs that made young Adam spill his Fresca all down the front of his jams. Enter James Cameron. At the first of several heights of his creative powers, a man so unbearable that he wrote Aliens and The Terminator and Rambo 2 at the same time. It's a period of creative output that is positively Herzogian. Except, you know, good. Well, not good good, but corny action good, which, as we've established, my cohorts think is the same as good, but which isn't. In 1979, the first movie, Alien, came out of nowhere, and in the new style of the time, when the cocaine was only 2 feet deep, the studio saw it as a franchise opportunity, which was a license to print money. This was right about the time that Detroit realized they didn't have to completely redesign all their cars every 3 years, and they settled into making the same K-cars and Fox Mustangs and Caprice classics unchanged for the next 25 years. Hollywood hired Cameron to make the sequel to Alien, and all he had to do was just show up, film a guy in a rubber suit covered with fake mucus, and then cash a big check. Just make a K-car, in other words. Instead, inspired, he wrote a 45-page treatment in 4 days, created a brand new world that felt close enough to the old world to seem like the same world, developed mostly new characters that likewise, and pivoted away from the horror genre and into a more conventional and profitable big-time action movie genre. Side note, when Adam sent me his first draft of this intro, it said right there, war movie genre, if that gives you any indication of how hard it is for me to do this job. People argue that this is a Vietnam War allegory. A technologically superior force ventures deep inside a hostile foreign environment, fighting an enemy that uses tunnels and guerrilla warfare tactics to surround and overwhelm. There are some badass Marines who are just regular folks trying to do their goddamn job on this fucked up mission. Also, like the Viet Cong, the aliens have acid for blood and are 8 feet tall and appear not to have eyes. You could argue that Heathers is a Vietnam War allegory if you want. Please post your essay on Medium where I can be sure not to read it. Anyway, Sigourney Weaver did not want to do this sequel either now that she was rolling, literally, in the big Ghostbusters bucks. But Cameron's persistence and the studio paychecks prevailed. Her personal apprehension mirrored that of her character, Ellen Ripley, who refuses sleazy Carter Burke's invitation to join the mission until finally she relents against her every best judgment. Paul Reiser somehow manages to tweak his trademark lovably anxious goofy Jewish dad persona, the same one that America gobbled up on My Two Dads and that one sitcom named after a Belinda Carlisle song, into one of the most disingenuously slimy, hateful, possibly anti-Semitic, toady villains in the history of film. He is a liar, we all know is lying, but we can't quite catch him in the lie, and for some reason we all go along with him with a pervading sense of dread until every suspicion we had about him is confirmed. So, the colonial Marines freeze-dry themselves and wake up at mining planet Hadley's Hope, where they sift through the aftermath of a great battle before they cash their ticket one by one in horrifying fashion. If we were watching this movie in a black neighborhood, everyone in the theater would be shouting, "Don't go in there!" for the whole second half of the film. The big bug enemy doesn't communicate. It never sends a list of demands. It definitely does not enlist the help of a young Jane Fonda to make its case more sympathetic to the American people. It just relentlessly surrounds and overwhelms. It's just a matter of time before Ripley and Newt are cocooned in slime and have adenoidal horseshoe crabs blast out of them. As all of Burke's promises are broken, the survivors fight on, both against the aliens and, by dint of their will to survive, the heartless corporate government forces that brought them to this place. It's a cocktail of combat, paranoia, action, offensively implausible biology, and horror. It is the Unicorn sequel. It expands upon its source material, yet is able to stand independently on its own merits. It is the Home Alone 2 of Vietnam allegories. Ripley is the quintessential strong female lead, a plausibly ferocious fighter, strategist, and leader. The Marines look up to her, the civilian advisor, and it isn't long before everyone in the film defers to her. And we, the audience, also defer to her. She is the only goddamn person in this movie, and maybe in this whole misbegotten world we can count on to get us out of this mess. She and Imperator Furiosa are the only people I trust anymore. And Sarah Connor. Squad goals. So, she saves the day, and Newt, and vanquishes her enemy in, well, frankly, at least from the perspective of alien historians, an orgy of genocidal baby-killing mayhem. Let's not take the analogies too far here. It's an ensemble film, it's a science fiction film, and yes, it's a war film, I guess. Although, no, it's not. Today's Friendly Fire places a substantial dollar value on this facility as we discuss the 1986 James Cameron sequel, Aliens.
Welcome to Friendly Fire, the war movie podcast we record as we pedal our Weyland-Yutani brand big wheel tricycles all over LV-426. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
And I'm John Roderick.
This, another movie that kind of strains the definition. It's definitely a soldier's movie.
Yeah, I wrestled with it throughout the whole thing, kind of wondering whether we needed to roll back the definition of war picture a little bit, get a little bit more stringent. But then I pictured Adam sitting in his easy chair just throwing popcorn at his face.
This is almost entirely a Vietnam War allegory. I can't believe that you're saying this. Are you kidding me?
John, maybe you just need to quit your grinning and drop your linen.
I guess so. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's an allegory, but you know, an allegory of a war film is not a war film.
The man in the black H.R. Giger inspired pajamas.
How dare you?
But I do feel like the amount, just the sheer amount of Marine Corps ordnance unloading. Like, just barely tipped it over into, like, authentic war movie. Yeah. And also, like, faceless, unknowable enemy that just keeps coming in waves.
And yeah. And the trope of, like, training and technology being unfit for the mission, you know, thinking that you're going to go to a place and just turn it upside down on the virtue of your superior firepower.
Right, the cockiness of the military that then they get their comeuppance. Yeah, all right. It is a war movie in many ways.
Hudson should have figured out how to get out of that chicken shit outfit way earlier.
It's officer versus enlisted too, in a relationship that we've seen a lot of times in these war movies.
True, and you've got the corporation, yeah. Which often is like, for instance, in Adam's other favorite movie, Rambo 2,
right,
in the form of some short-sleeved CIA. Minions.
You think you're making fun of me with lines like that, but you're not.
I know. You're just like, yes.
Movies of this era always make me want to ask John if he saw this in the theater and what the circumstances of seeing it were at that time.
So, Alien, I was too young to see in the theater because I was not... like a horror movie dude as a kid and my people weren't, so there was no like, let's go see the new like super horrifying nightmare movie. So when Alien came out, I was that was 1979, and I was I did not see it. And I think I have seen Alien only in VHS, but Aliens came out the summer after I graduated from high school.
That's the perfect time.
So it was like, it came out in July. I'd been out of high school for a month and a half or something like that. But I had left Anchorage and was hitchhiking across America by the middle of July 1986. So I didn't see Aliens right away because I was like pretty far out of the... I was off the grid, bros. But it was such a popular movie that it stayed in theaters long enough that I caught it at a discount theater while it was still in the theaters, but it was like a, you know, a 99-cent movie or something in an afternoon. So I saw it on the big screen, and it was really, for by 1986 standards, it was really astonishing how good it looked, how real it felt. It just blew every other kind of sci-fi movie out of the water.
And most of these effects really hold up.
Yeah.
Like there's a couple of parts where you're like, it's a little tiny model. But, I mean, like, there's still stuff in there that I don't even know how they did. Like, the loader mech that they used to pick up missiles and load them into the dropship.
Yeah, that looks great.
It's perfect.
Yeah.
It also... it doubled down on the dirty future that Star Wars kind of began. And I'm wondering, I guess, for
and
its
Blade
time,
Runner.
Yeah, did this film win over Star Wars people in any demonstrable way? Or if you were a sci-fi fan in the 80s, did you like and consume it all? Even by today's standards, I feel like Aliens is such a unique film that you could play it for as new right now, and it would be as incredible as it must have been in the mid-80s.
Yeah, I think so. In the 80s, that H.R. Giger look, or Giger, I don't know how you guys would insist it be pronounced.
I believe it's pronounced Spokane.
That style of art was very contemporary and widely disseminated. There were some magazines, like there was a magazine called Heavy Metal Magazine that had that kind of artwork in it. Omni Magazine. It was sci-fi culture was ascendant then, and it was really interested in lizardy aliens and like greasy, dirty futures. So it felt very contemporary. I mean, it was still astonishing to see it like laid out in front of you. But I think for most sci-fi fans, myself included, movies like this that were set in the not that distant future.
Yeah.
Made us really expectant, you know, in the same way that people in the 50s and 60s were like, okay, flying cars any day now. I think people my age saw movies like this and were like, yes, okay, because we were in space, right? We had space shuttles. Like, it was plausible. When you see that shot at the beginning that's part of the extra footage,
yeah,
of that space station, shit, man, that seems buildable.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, why the hell don't we have that for
Let's
the love of
get up there
God?
And build that shit.
Yeah, like, what the hell, Elon Musk? Like, get it done.
This is such a near future thing, too. Like, I think this film is set in the 2100s.
Yeah.
And that's such an interesting version of the future to see.
I had this fantasy watching it, like, what if this film was just set in 1986, but like a version of 1986 where we had space?
It kind of was,
I mean, the problem with all these films is that there's, you know, bad, grainy, analog pixel shit happening on all the TV, like the, you know, CRT TV screens, and that looks impossibly dated now. And then when Ridley Scott goes back in 2015 and makes Alien Covenant or whatever, it's like everything's a hologram and everything's super clean and super, super advanced looking, and it's supposed to be a prequel to this. Mm. And it's like, I think the cooler move is make it look like the 70s imagined space would be, you know?
Yeah, right. I mean, they sit down and they're basically working at Compaq portable computers.
Yeah.
Green screen, like, rewrite the encryption.
Ben, you and I probably saw it. I know the first time I saw this film, I didn't have the good fortune of seeing it in a theater, but it was after renting a Laserdisc player from a video store. And after finding out, like, I had watched the VHS for years, but this special edition was going to be amazing because of its 20 minutes of extra footage. It was only available on Laserdisc at the time. And so me and a bunch of high school friends rented a Laserdisc player and then watched it.
You pooled your crumpled up pocket bills.
Yeah.
And fun.
Well, let me ask you guys this, because we've seen already a couple of films on our show, Apocalypse Now and Star Wars both leap to mind. Are films where the director later on came in and added other stuff. In the Apocalypse Now case, you are still welcome to watch the actual film and not the abortion. In the Star Wars film, you are forced.
You say that like abortion is a bad thing, John. I just want to remind our audience that we're all dyed-in-the-wool liberals here, and we are not just pro-choice, we are pro-abortion.
Look, my position on directors' versions is that they should be safe and rare.
That's right. Well, and also, like, as much as I sit around being super duper pro abortion, I do not watch them for entertainment. But this is like the really rare case, and you know, in Blade Runner, it's arguable which of the 45 different versions of it is the canonical one. I like them all. But this one, the additional footage, this was the first time I'd ever seen it with the additional footage.
Mm-hmm.
And it not only does it belong in the movie, but it really advances so many of the what had formerly been kind of obscure or unarticulated plot points.
Right.
Like, it just adds so much. And the missing footage looks great. It's, like, smart. Like, what were they thinking, first of all? But, like, you guys tell me, when did the missing footage show up in the movie? And is that the first version you saw?
The studio made Cameron shorten the film, like, for time. Like, that was purely a time decision up front.
That's awful.
And he wasn't fuck the studio James Cameron yet.
Right. He wasn't fuck the studio James Cameron. He also, this film was still being worked the week before it was released. So his ability to gain any kind of leverage to complete things that may have been unfinished leading up to its release date, like, there was none. He either made his window or he didn't. And fuck you, James Cameron, as Ben said, like, didn't exist yet. He couldn't push a deadline out at this moment in his career.
Is this the first version that you saw?
No.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard for me to remember. I think I've seen both versions, and I probably saw the original version first. But, like, the gun turret scene,
I understand
to be something that was added back in.
Yeah, that wasn't in the film.
I think of that as canonically part of the film. So sure. I think that the special edition is the one that I envision when I think about this film.
As a high schooler, the sentry guns were the thing that stuck out to me as the big ad. But as an adult, it was the scene where Ripley finds out about her deceased daughter and the way that that loop gets closed by the end of the film, that Ripley gets to become a mother again. That was deeply satisfying.
That was a huge part of the film. Like, yeah. We never heard about Ripley's daughter except, I'm not even sure if that scene where Newt asks her if she ever had a kid, I don't remember whether that was in the first version or not, but you did not have that, like...
Yeah, all references to her daughter were removed from the theatrical version. This is just a purely...
That's insane. You know, that's like...
That's like the core of the movie.
Huge motivation for her character, and also, like, oh my God, it breaks your heart. The last time she saw her daughter, she was 11, and Newt is what, like, 9?
Yeah.
It's such a beautiful closure. but also the scene, the entire concept that Burke had sent the email basically to the colony saying, hey, go out and check out this thing and see if you can grab some of these eggs. Like the whole blood on Burke's hands thing was not explicated as much as it was in this version.
In a film that is full of like terrifying images, that single chuck wagon going out to the crashed alien ship is so deeply terrifying. Because they show so little, like you see the chuck wagon go out, you know it's full of a nuclear family. You see mom and dad head in, but you really don't see what happens inside that ship. All you see is the consequence later. It's brutal.
Was that a GMC RV?
Hey now, careful with that kind of talk. I love that Adam is referencing, I'm assuming, the chuck wagon dog food commercials of the 1970s. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah.
Yeah!
Ready to feed the puppies, Mom?
Ready!
The thing is that one thing that you guys cannot ever do, and that seems like a small thing, but it's actually a big thing, is see this movie without knowing who Paul Reiser is.
Mm.
This was one of the first, his first appearances. I mean, he was in Diner, but I hadn't seen Diner. You know, most the audience for Diner and the audience for Aliens.
Well, it's on the list, so we'll see it eventually.
Another one of your guys' pork chop movies, except literally like they're eating pork chops. But Paul Reiser was an unknown actor. He had not done any television shows yet. I mean, he wasn't unknown, but his character was not something that everybody was soaked in like we are now. And so here was this actor appearing on the screen and not knowing who Paul Reiser is. If you can watch that performance and imagine it's the first time you've ever seen this guy, that smarm.
He's
and
so
that,
good.
Like from the moment he arrives on the screen, you're like, I don't trust this guy. And yet he's like really broadcasting how trustworthy he is. I mean, it was a very, he was the scariest thing in the movie from the start.
Yeah, he's the guy that will put the profits of the company ahead of human life every single time.
Yeah, and he somehow believes it internally, but he's also just like always spinning and weaseling. And
I think he's a sociopath.
That's the biggest thing, John. Like when you say that he believes it internally, like that is the deepest manifestation of evil is the guy who thinks he's doing it right, even though he is evil.
I worried that on this viewing that it's a little, it's slightly anti-Semitic, the portrayal.
I debated this with my wife a little bit because I've always felt that. And she was like, no, I don't think so. I don't think that they're making him a Jew, but it's a Jewish actor playing a money-loving evil corporate man.
I don't think it crosses the line over into it, but it's certainly... It reverberates pretty close to that line in a way that in 1986 nobody would have commented on, I don't think, outside of maybe the New Yorker. But now I think that portrayal would get called out.
He refers to the Marines as tough hombres, and I wonder if that's where Trump's coinage of bad hombres derives from.
I always thought it was probably from a ZZ Top song, but...
I think I've heard James Cameron talking about how there are Marines in his family, and this movie for him was like kind of about paying tribute to what that life is like. And they really do exalt in the kind of quotidian life of Marines toward the beginning of this film, like when they're like coming out of the cryopods and the sergeant is like popping the stogie in his mouth and walking up and down, twanging on them that every day in the Corps is a great day and every paycheck is a fortune.
Yeah, they didn't really oorah it quite enough or semper fi it. They didn't, you know, like they did quite a bit of Marine culture building, but I felt like it was not accurate, actually. Like, for instance, Hudson calls his... gunny sergeant or top sergeant, he calls him sir at one point. Right when they're getting out, he's like, sir, can I ask a question? And that he would have just gotten his ears boxed for that. That's not They wouldn't have called a sergeant sir.
Well, you don't know how things are in 2100 or whatever.
I mean, you're right. I'm not like the expert on the Marine Corps culture, but what I wanted, I think, was there was them to be a little bit more correct. I love that like chest bumping vibe once they got into battle.
Yeah.
But when they're first waking up from the pods and they immediately are just like a bunch of high schoolers, I felt like even if they were hardened combat vets with 42 drops or whatever they were claiming to be, I feel like they would have been able to muster proper uniforms and, you know, like at least come correct at the start. It felt a little bit corny that they were already like in the foxholes.
But if they come out of the cryo chambers as strict Marines right off the bat, it anonymizes their personalities in a way that make you not feel anything when they're eventually killed. Like, this is a sort of a masterclass in establishing like a large ensemble cast made up of individuals. Like, you need this scene in order to get to know them as individuals. If they come to attention right away, like, there's nothing there.
I feel like they could have split the difference. So I wouldn't call it a masterclass. I would call it a baccalaureate grade class.
I think the efficiency in developing characters for each of these individuals is what makes it a masterclass. Like, everyone is different from another person, and there's like 12 of them. And for a film of this length, I just think that's a pretty great magic trick that was able to be done.
This is also the first film we've seen, I think, that has women as like totally integrated into a military unit. And I wondered like how that played in 1986 when that was like a super controversial idea.
Well, it's funny because this movie has like in some ways the strongest female lead in film.
Right.
Even to this day. And also was very anti-corporatist, anti-capitalist. And I think it's tantalizing for a 2018 audience to think, and we've talked about this before, it's very tantalizing for us in the present day to think that this is the first moment in time when there has been feminism and anti-capitalism. and that we have completely invented both of those things and everyone that came before was just living in enslavement and ignorance. But this movie was certainly like radical and affirming. 1986 audiences were ready for Sigourney Weaver to be a badass. And this movie really, I mean, it was an enormous hit. And the idea that in 86, people weren't already very, very conscious of the fact that Hollywood did not have strong female leads and that and Sigourney Weaver's performance and Oscar nomination for that performance were greeted just like Wonder Woman or Black Panther were greeted this year as like welcome and it's about time. And like people were super down with it.
Was it controversial in the way, like, you get a Breitbart-type website writing screeds against Wonder Woman or whatever? Like, was there a portion of the body politic that hated what aliens represented?
Well, sure. And the great thing about science fiction is that, you know, the people that want to roll their eyes,
they're like, I like that it's against Jews, but I don't like that it's pro-women.
You know, and but you see that in our culture now, right? There are a lot of people that wanted to go see Black Panther because they love superhero movies, but then they go and they sit there kind of like mad at the like Black Power message, but it doesn't keep them from going to watch like the ass-kicking fighting movie.
Right.
And in a lot of ways, like, the amount of color blindness or like sex bias blindness that a lot of people, that if you really challenge them about it, they're going to have what we would think of as being kind of bogus opinions. But if you don't get right in their face about it and you let them just be bathed in a fantasy, They're going to, I mean, there were so many people that went to see Aliens that didn't believe there should be women in the military, but they're also able to say like, well, maybe 100 years from now, it'll be fine. Or, you know, I mean, these are the same people that are like, oh, well, you know, I don't think, I don't like black people, but my friend Charlie is great.
Yeah. Those are Hudson people.
Yeah, like, it's like, that like kind of thing.
To them, Hudson's the main character in this film.
Right, because Hudson's like,
have you ever been mistaken for a man?
John, honey, it's late.
And he just gets shut down, and everybody cheers, except for the people in the audience who are like, well, he's got a point.
Yeah.
You know, there's like, it's just, I don't think the divisions between people, I mean, we're living in a world where where even saying that sounds crazy. But the actual divisions between people are not as great as we're pouring so much energy right now into how different we are from each other. But anybody that lives in America can see that Sigourney Weaver is a badass, and that thank God she's in this movie, because little by little everyone else is incompetent. Like, she doesn't stride into this job.
Yeah.
Right, she's like, I don't want to go, I don't want to do this, I just want to, oh my god, all right, I'll go. And then she's like, all right, shit, I'll go, okay, sure, teach me how to use a gun, fine. You know, like, at each stage of the thing she's like, oh fuck, can nobody else do this?
She's the reluctant hero.
And you know, and it's great because it's completely believable, and by the end you're like, everyone else is screwed up and she goes back in and you believe it. There's nothing in her performance that for a second questions whether or not she's the most capable person on this mission.
It's earned because she's not there purely for revenge. Like, she's trying to destroy the thing that is psychologically torturing her. Like, she can't live a normal life unless she goes back to the planet.
Well, and she's such a good actor.
Yeah.
I've never seen a film that establishes a character so early on. Paul Reiser is like is a schemer from the very beginning, but the first interaction they have, she's like, can you just shut the fuck up and tell me what I'm asking?
Yeah.
You know, like, she takes no shit from him. She is never once bamboozled by him.
Yeah, she is not like wowed by the cut of his Savile Row future suit.
It's such an interesting, like, good cop, bad cop thing that the corporation does with Burke too, because Burke is like the public facing PR guy. He's the guy who's supposed to have a conscience, and he comes in carrying the cat. But like during that inquiry panel scene, like, the members of the people judging Ripley don't even call her by her name. Like, they call her E. Ripley. Like, she's so anonymized to them. She's only a person to Burke. And that's what makes the rat fuck hurt so much more later on. It's like this misplaced trust.
He sees an angle, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He's trying to manipulate her rather than be straight with her, because he can't be straight.
That scene is a real James Cameron movie. I don't want to say trope. I want to say something less strong than trope. But like, the idea that Ripley is so much like Sarah Connor in that scene, and that she's been a witness to something terrible and no one believes her, and she's predicting something terrible to come and no one wants to believe that either. And she just loses it in that room and is seen to be an insane person. And they just sort of tut-tut her and pat her on the head and say, we're going to take away your rank so you can go work down at the docks. Like, this is a thing that James Cameron movies do. They, like, disempower and empower their female leads.
Yeah, they, like, while officially disempowering, wind up, you know, like, the female leads are always stronger than the disempowerment that they are confronting.
In every Cameron film, there's like enormous subtexts of class. And both Sarah Connor is a blue collar restaurant worker. Not special, not college educated, not the center even of her own life. And Ripley is in Alien. She was, I guess, the commander of the ship.
No, what's the guy? The guy from MASH is the captain.
But she's like some kind of, I don't know, but in this film, she is established early on as low rank, basically. And the only reason she's on this mission is as an advisor, but she's not...
Tom Skerritt is the captain.
Tom Skerritt, all right? You know, like her, the whole thing about her being a forklift operator and that being how she establishes her credibility with the troops, it's all very blue-collar fetishizing. She's being relegated or ghosted by the corporates, but it's as much a class issue as it is a gender issue. She's just like this low-status person, and why should she be believed? And then throughout the film, where we're given the opportunity to feel like all of this, you know, all this highfalutin stuff is no match for a gal and her front end loader.
Those ammo counters go.
Al Matthews plays Apone, and in the exposition part where we're getting to know all the characters, he has maybe 8 lines that are totally unique reads to that actor. Like, I don't know whether it's the cigar in his mouth or just the look of bemusement on his face when he and Hicks watch her in the loader, but that scene always cracks me up. Like when she asks them where they want it and he says, Bay 12, please. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like you could take 10 runs at that line and not arrive at that choice that he makes. And you could say that about all of these. Like, this entire ensemble takes such unique reads at their lines that I think it serves to differentiate their characters from each other.
When he does that, like, Hudson, get over here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like so strong, but you also feel the compassion and the love he has for his men, you know? Yeah. It's just like,
it's a thing that, who's the superhero writer director that kills all of his characters famously? Joss Whedon, right?
Yeah.
It's a thing that modern storytellers and filmmakers are only now like really doing a lot, which is like making characters into people you love and then killing them for emotional effect. Like Apone, I think, is the third to die in the first raid. But as soon as he goes, it tips the entire film into holy shit. Like we have lost.
This guy was supposed to protect us.
He's the one holding it all together.
Yeah. And in a scene where like 5 Marines die in rapid succession, for Apone to be one of them was so terrifying. Because after that point, the rest of the surviving Marines are screaming at each other about what to do. And fucking Gorman is in the APC, not talking loud enough to be heard by anyone.
Well, that's so disturbing. Where he's just like, just losing it. I mean, the classic lieutenant about to get fragged.
Yeah.
They did a great job giving background to that lieutenant character too, like sitting by himself in the mess hall, admitting to not being on very many jumps. Like there's efficiency in his background there. Like they drop a few breadcrumbs for him where you know exactly, like you can predict with some accuracy that he's going to fuck things up later.
Well, that's also kind of a trope, like the super wet behind the ears lieutenant straight from West Point who's never seen any action, you know.
And you know not to trust him because his first scene is with Burke.
Although that's an added in scene. That wasn't in the original.
Yeah.
And he arrives in the movie. First of all, Ben, he did not go to West Point. He's a Marine lieutenant.
I'm saying it's a trope. It's a trope in other things.
Naval Academy.
Right, but in like Band of Brothers, this character exists as well, and that's the Army. So, eat a brown one.
No, I'm afraid not. You do not. You're going to get. This is a war movie podcast, and we are trying to appeal to old veterans, and that's the type of thing that they're going to go out and they're going to put 2 bullets in the hood of their 1967. GTO in the garage because they're so mad.
Well, my role on the show, John, is actually to dunk on pedants like you. And that's why I would like to bring up my signature segment, Dunking on the Pedants. And today we're going to do a slightly different, we have a modification. It's out pedant the pedants. Oh. So I'm going to offer you something that somebody quibbled with on IMDb. I'm going to see if either of you can buzz in with your name and see if you can headcanon why this quibble is incorrect. When Ripley is arming to rescue Newt, she takes grenades from a case that is clearly marked 40 millimeters. The Marines use pulse rifles with 30 millimeter launchers.
Huh. she puts those grenades into a bandolier and then throws them into the fire.
Correct.
Right. Those are fire grenades only.
Yeah. Boo. Yeah.
Suck on that, pedant. I had a lot of fun looking through the like, you know, most of IMDb is like continuity errors. Like, oh, there was like 3/4 of a cup of coffee in the coffee cup in this angle. But then in this other angle, there wasn't that much coffee at all. But like the military pedants that quibble about like, you know, Sergeant Apone being referred to as top, but he doesn't have enough stripes on his chevrons to be called that is like a whole different breed.
He doesn't have enough stripes on his chevrons. Oh, he doesn't have enough stripes on his chevrons, the man said.
God, I'm, you know, you're right, John. I should go back and edit the script that I'm speaking from to be a little bit more.
Oh, listen, if you can't handle the fact that you are a figure of fun on this show, then maybe you should go start another show, which is called Too Sensitive to Do Podcasts with John. And you can have a bunch of people on that show.
As one third owner of the name Friendly Fire, if I do go do that show, I'm going to need you guys to change this show to John can't keep the podcast moving because he's too caught up in somebody slightly misspeaking to be entertaining.
Listen, I'm not the one that threw the brakes on this conversation to like to throw his dirty diaper around the room. I just made a funny joke.
I'm really excited to hear this conversation after the credits when this episode comes out.
I think this is right in the middle of the episode. Like, you thought it was a war movie podcast. It's just a war podcast, and it's Ben and John going to war with each other slowly over the course of 35 episodes.
This is the After Dark stuff that that subscribers get access to.
We're on express elevator to hell. Going down.
Is this film just the like, oh, the superior firepower up against an enemy that doesn't play by the rules? Or is there something about the... I mean, who are the enemy?
You could argue that it's Weyland-Yutani the entire time.
Mm-hmm. Did Weyland-Yutani, did they send the initial crew out there? Like, how did they initially discover the aliens in the movie Alien?
Like, comparing the two Red Dawns, I really want to try to focus the pod on this film as its own thing. And like the way we did with Star Wars, too. Like, there's the greater Aliens universe is something we could really get in the weeds on. And I think a lot of people who saw this movie made this their first and only Aliens universe film before being disappointed by the third.
Yeah, I think this was the first one I saw, and for the most part, the only one I remember seeing.
Yeah. Who do you think the enemy is?
Capitalism. And capitalism has unleashed and continues to not understand the danger of these space lizards. But like, you could argue that the aliens are nuclear weapons, because we have they've been unleashed and we don't understand their true power, but we continue and they proliferate and we continue to to fail to appreciate the danger. And
they seek to commoditize something that they don't understand and is also very dangerous too, right? Like, Burke's whole idea is to turn the aliens into a weapon.
To weaponize them. Right. So it's biological warfare is it's alluding to. I mean, but then at the end, the queen alien, there's an attempt made to humanize her. She's the first one of the enemy that's given any motivation beyond just assimilate and destroy. That scene where Ripley has Newt, is confronting her and points her flamethrower at the eggs, and the queen backs off and her guards back off.
There's such great like wordless storytelling there too, because then, yeah, you know, like, the queen basically breaks the deal of, I'll leave your eggs alone if you leave me and Newt alone.
Yeah, right, because that egg, like, pops open.
Yeah.
And the look that Ripley gives the queen, like, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah. It's really heavy. And at that point also, you know, there's this like female versus female antagonism, mother versus mother, that's like unique in war movies, unless you allow for the fact that gunnery sergeants feel like the mothers to their little hens, which I think does happen in films, right? You get that feeling that the sergeant is the mother character. But this is a film where it's like mother versus mother there. That's pretty heavy dynamic. That's a pretty heavy energy, like universal energy, to bring into a war context and into the central conflict.
Besides the mother versus mother relationship, there's also the fraternity of all of these Marines too. Like there's a different kind of family being depicted here as well.
Even with like strong integrated female characters in the platoon, it's still very fraternal.
Right.
You can tell because of all the chin-ups everyone's doing.
Lot of chin-ups.
Let's rock!
I mean, we haven't really talked about the primary female soldier who actually ends up sort of being the primary soldier, the most badass, Vasquez.
Yeah.
Played by a Jewish actress, BTW.
Really?
Who is doing a Hispanic character. Maybe that would not pass muster in today's world either.
Holy shit, she's the foster mom in Terminator 2.
Yeah.
Damn.
They gave her dark contact lenses and a spray tan to make her Vasquez.
Wow.
And you know, and she actually does kind of have a little bit of like ASA. I mean, she's got some accent too, so which is a little complicated.
Little bit definitely would not pass muster in 2018, like I think you'd have some very angry people if you released a film where that happened now.
Yeah, agreed.
Her character really gets a chance to step up too, because after the Marines are wiped out in the first assault, it's basically just the her Hicks and Hudson show.
And she's the one that's the most gung-ho every time. She never breaks. She never cracks, you know, until that last moment.
Well, she cracks when Drake dies.
She does, yeah, that's right. That's right. Because she and Drake had like some, that was the most solid bond of anybody in the film.
They were the Steadicam buddies.
I love that relationship and how it never made it seem as though Drake was trying to fuck her.
Or it was like love bond. It was
right.
Like total soldierly love bond.
It was closer than friends, or even closer than what a romance could be. It was like ultimate respect.
I think that character in 1986, way more than anything else, was the thing that really resonated at that time, right? Like Starship Troopers was 10 years later, and Starship Troopers really upped the ante on co-ed military portrayal.
Co-ed shower portrayal, for example.
But Vasquez as a character really rang everybody's bell. Because this was, 86 was when we were just sort of introducing women into the armed forces in roles that involved more action like this. But the argument was that a woman just wasn't physically strong enough to be in combat. And that argument persisted all the way through the Clinton years. And I mean, there's tons and tons of people that would make that argument now. But this character was such a, like, she just was so over capable throughout the film that I think it, I don't think anybody doubted it, because she really, the performance really kicks ass. It was just like, a lot of us, myself included, like walked out of the theater really chewing on Vasquez and just like, whoa.
Yeah.
Wow. Like, yeah, man.
She's very headstrong and very gung-ho, but then the second somebody speaks reason to her, she's able to accommodate that. Like when Ripley yells like, we're not going to go back and rescue them, they're already done for, like there's nothing we can do, Vasquez is prepared to believe that, you know.
Yeah, well, and she keeps Hudson in line more than anybody else. Even though he flips her a lot of shit in the beginning of the film, like he follows her lead.
Yeah.
Her emotional journey, I think, might be the most developed, because at the end, she actually arrives at a moment of forgiveness with Gorman, when they detonate the grenade in the ventilation shaft.
Oh my God, that's a really touching moment.
Yeah.
Like Gorman becomes a hero, and she, in that, when he flips that grenade and she puts her hand over it, and then like they kind of like embrace, like she quadruple humanizes and he does too. It's like, really, there's so much going on in that 30 seconds.
They don't even give you any time to like chew on it, because the next thing that happens is the shockwave from the explosion drops Newt down the ventilation hole.
Yeah, Ben, let's talk about how this film develops its story, because one of the notes that I wrote down was how strict the script stuck with buts. Like, there's always this thing happens, but another thing happens as a consequence. I wrote down like 20 of these, but this is a great moment to start talking about it. Like, that grenade knocks Newt down the air vent. They find Newt, but she's taken. Ripley rescues Newt, but she's in a field full of eggs. They escape the queen, but the elevator doesn't come. It's right. Butts all the way down. Like, it is relentless. There are no victories without the cost of something else in this film.
Right. They get all the way back to the ship, but the queen hitched a ride.
Right, right.
Ouch. Like, come on. Give us a break at a certain point.
I don't think there's a moment in the film that doesn't come with one of these.
Yeah, you basically, like, until the queen is out the airlock, you don't get a break. And that's what's so great and so scary about this movie villain, is like, it is like biologically optimized to be relentless. Like, every, like, you shoot the alien, but its blood splashes all over you and burns your skin off, you know?
And that's like the major complaint about modern horror storytelling, is like, both the enemy makes mistakes and your protagonists decide on stupid courses of action. Outside of Gorman being just sort of unfit for leadership, I feel like everyone involved in this film are making decisions that make practical sense.
Right. And Gorman's not necessarily not making smart decisions. He's just not making them fast enough.
Right.
I guess collecting the ammunition from everybody is like his one weird thing, because it doesn't seem like the order is totally honored. Like, it's like, yeah, here's my magazine, but here's the shotgun I have down the front of my trousers that I'm not giving you the ammunition from.
I feel like the scenes where they introduced the perimeter guns, those also introduced a thing that was not in the original film, which is that those guns unloaded, just killed, and then finally, the second time, with 10 bullets left, the aliens retreated. It's a thing that wasn't in the earlier film. You never got a feeling that the aliens behaved rationally. They were just relentless, always. But in that scene, we saw that they were capable of being scared, or they were capable of feeling like, okay, this isn't working, let's regroup and try something else. And that introduced the idea that they were something, that they had sentience, they were something more than just endless soldiers, which I think gave the film a lot more tension, you know? And it allowed for that scene later when she and the queen had that bargain. It gave you a feeling of like, oh, they are thinking.
In a lot of movies, I think a frequent complaint is about its spatial orientation, and that during action scenes, you can't really tell where the characters are in relation to each other or in relation to their setting. I think this film, if there's one knock against it, it doesn't do a great job in establishing its geography in relation to anything else. Like, the compound seems a little bit unknowable geographically, but I think that helps to serve the claustrophobia of it. What did you think of that?
In the original film, I had no idea where we were geographically at any time. In this movie, there's a little bit more of that outside footage and a clear delineation between the atmosphere building and the other quarters, right? Because they make that transit between the one and the other. They fortify the control tower at a certain point, and there's just a little bit more geography. But I agree that throughout the whole second act of the film, like, I have no idea whether that building has 400 floors or four, or, you know, whether it was like also wide as well as tall. Like, when she goes back in, you do get a sense that she's making a long, long trip, both down and then throughout. And that's kind of important. You know, she leaves those flares. And as she's running back, it's a little detail because there's so much steam and like and light in those scenes. But you do see the flares. She is following her flares back to the elevator. So that, I think, gives the sense that she doesn't know what the geography is either. And I wasn't as bothered by it this time.
Right. Neither was I. Maybe that's because there were so many other distracting things in the film. Like, its tension lies elsewhere.
Ben, what did you think of it? You're usually pretty conscious of geography.
I think that, like, in an individual battle, like, it's pretty obvious that the aliens are coming from, you know, point X, and they're exiting via door Z or whatever. Like, I almost think that the shapes of the spaces feel more like metaphorical in this film in a weird way. Like in a Red Dawn 2012, when everybody's like, you know, shooting Kalashnikovs down off the top of a roof, and then the camera turns around and you're like, wait, which roof are they on? Like, that's like, that's a real, they're trying to establish like the dimensions of a real battle in a real place. And I feel like almost like the lack of information in this movie is being used to amplify how scary it is. And it's like intentional in a way that it feels like a mistake sometimes in other movies. And they even like go so far as to have maps in this movie of the spaces, but they're like confusing. And, you know, you could never read this map in a million years.
Yeah, you're right. I think it is intentional.
Yeah.
And successful.
Yeah.
Successful in that.
Definitely. Yeah. Like, I feel like they made an active choice. Like we can make this space anything we want it to be. So let's do it this way because this will be scarier.
Why not make it suck?
Yeah. Scene is disorganized.
I've seen this movie in a couple of different contexts. And I also, you know, it's a movie and not reality. But I caught myself many times, like, all tensed up, like, in an awkward sitting position, shoulders hunched, squeezing, you know, my arms just sort of, and then there would be something that released the tension and I would like relax for a second and realize how physically torqued up I was just because of that claustrophobia and the fact that their sensors only ever indicate that they are being converged upon from all sides.
Yeah, like those beeps never start to get further apart.
No, those sensors are fucking awful. That's just like, oh, I'm getting a reading. Oh, there's 10,000 of them and they're coming from all directions.
Yeah.
It's like, fuck.
Yeah, it's like sensor as tempo, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, it's literally like beep, 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 beep,
yeah.
Beep, beep,
beep. You want to get some nice alien Doppler effect as those aliens run away.
As a parent, John, what did you make of Carrie Henn's portrayal as Newt, and how did her character affect you? Did it affect you differently, you think, now than it would have 20 years ago?
I was on the lookout for that, and there are a lot of movies, scary movies or, you know, Liam Neeson movies, whatever kind of movies those are.
That's where its own genre.
I feel like they very cheaply basically take a child, put that child in jeopardy, and then we're all supposed to respond to the fact that the child is being hurt. And it's a super cheap thing that you see in films all the time, where it's just like, oh, hurt a child, because you don't have good screenwriting skills. Mm-hmm. Like, you were not able to make a movie interesting, so you hurt a child. It's like the worst possible shortcut. But in this film, like, Newt is, and even leaving out her appearance earlier on, the one thing I didn't need was establishing Newt's character early. Mm-hmm. Because Newt appeared in the original film just sort of halfway through. It's like, oh, they find this little ragamuffin running around in the heating vents. like, we didn't need to see her back when she was a nice little girl with parents. Like, she worked as a character that just appears.
Yeah.
But she was fully fledged. Like, she came in, she was all shell-shocked. But from the moment she says, "Nobody calls me Rebecca, my name is Newt," she's more than just a cousin Oliver. She's not just there to be cute and give thumbs ups. You know, she advances the plot. She's the one that knows her way around the geography of the station better than anybody.
She acts in her own interest in a way that a lot of child characters never do.
Right.
Like, she seeks to save herself at every point, and she's wise about it.
Right. When Ripley says to her, like, "Well, you know, we've got these Marines," or whatever, she's just like, "Doesn't matter. It's not going to matter." You're like, whoa, kid's got a 1,000-yard stare. So right at the end, when she falls down the heating vent, and you want to say, like, "Oh, come on, please, come on, don't do this to us." And then you've got her wading around in the water with the little doll. It does cross the line of, like, okay, now you're just fucking with us. You know, you've basically taken this character who's totally real, and she kind of gets diminished a little bit. She's turned into just a little girl holding a doll wading through waist-deep water that you know is full of bugs.
Right.
But it only lasts a little while. Once she's grabbed by the alien, then the fact that it's like a little girl in jeopardy goes away again, because this isn't the first time that we've seen somebody we love get grabbed and watched a character wrestle with the desire to go get them.
Right.
So we've seen that a bunch, and it's just that in the past, in this film, it was never clear. It was pretty clear, in fact, that you couldn't go get them, because we see it several times. Like, "I know he's still alive, but he's gone, man. He's gone."
Well, I guess that might be another Vietnam metaphor there too. The idea of a prisoner of war being taken and unable to be rescued.
Yeah, there it is, Rambo 2 once again. But I, as a parent, I didn't feel manipulated at any point other than that one scene where she's wading through the water, and you're just like, this is really, you know, this is like horror movie trope rather than terror movie, which it is most of the time.
That composition was so different from so many other scenes too, because everywhere on the station is claustrophobic, and yet the moment Newt falls into the sewer, that set looks like the biggest, most wide open one that we've seen. It's almost shot like a movie poster with a lot of empty space.
What are the colonists of Hadley's Hope eating?
Yeah, it's basically the trash compactor.
The deeply unpopular Hadley's Hope P.F. Chang's.
Bryce, Jim, look out!
This came out a couple years after The Terminator. I don't know what made the bigger splash for Cameron, but the establishing shots in this film are amazing. And efficiency keeps on being like the buzzword for me, but Cameron never reveals anything in a shot that isn't paid off later. Like, you get the idea that there are these power loaders and several of them. You get the shot of the second dropship. You see the airlock very early on, yeah, and then not for another 2 hours. The cameras and the vitals that they establish when the Marines first go down to the planet. Like, there is nothing that is shown that is not paid off later. And I think that's just expertly done. And it's something I didn't notice from the first Terminator film. Like, I feel like this is Cameron really coming into his own here.
Yeah, I think the first Terminator film is more of a Roger Corman situation. Like,
yeah,
it definitely earned him, like, "Hey, like, give me a massive budget and I will make a massive movie" status. But it, you know, like... the effects in the first Terminator movie are, like, super corny now. And this is a totally different situation. Like, 2 years later, he's working at such a higher level.
There are a few moments in this movie where now I look at it and I realize, like, oh, there's some kind of green screen thing happening here that changed the color tonality, or like things look washed out, or the focal length have changed somehow.
There's some rear projection going on.
Yeah, like when the dropship crashes and they all have to run from the falling wreckage. That's definitely a rear projection effect.
Yeah, and I think the when she's standing on the platform and she's like, "Oh, Bishop!" And then he shows up and it's kind of like there's a lot going on special effects wise in those scenes. But I think watching it before and even now, the weird green screen chemical vibe, the different foci and the kind of the fog in the room type of thing, I almost felt like the weakness of the special effects at the time added to the experience of the otherworldliness of it.
Right. Mm.
The heat waves kind of did a lot of masking of that. I don't know how they accomplished that effect.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like that last scene where she's hugging Newt to her chest on the platform and she thinks Bishop has bugged out and left her there to die and all is lost is like not a realistic shot at all, and yet it totally works somehow.
Yeah, it does. It works. Like the special effects really work. Like Blade Runner now, when I watch it, I can see there are people standing outside holding giant lights and beaming them in the windows. But I've seen that movie 60 times. So you start to be able to see the special effects. And I'm sure if you watch this 60 times, you would see them too. But it's very successful at creating an atmosphere. But the thing is, I didn't know. I mean, the Terminator special effects, like when he transports back to the alley and we see him like, bzzzt, oh, here he is. Like, that's all terrible.
John, it's late.
But it just didn't matter because Terminator was so, that just dropped like a bomb on us too.
Yeah.
In the era.
Well, we have five more Avatar movies to look forward to in James Cameron's immediate future, so.
That makes me so sad.
Yeah.
What do you mean that there aren't really five Avatar movies, are there?
That, like Sigourney Weaver's IMDb has her listed in Avatar 2 through 6 or something. Like the last one coming out in 2026, I think.
He's such a competent storyteller that it just makes me sad that he's using all his resources toward a technological version of storytelling versus what we saw early on in his career. Like I think he's one of the country's best filmmakers, and I mean, this is self-inflicted what he's doing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think part of that is he's the guy that told Fox to cut him a bigger check and fuck off when they came down to see why The Abyss was taking so long and so over budget. Like,
yeah.
I think that the two things are kind of part and parcel. He's got a crazy ego and like believes in himself so unflinchingly. He like broke up with one of his, I don't know if it was Catherine Bigelow or one of his other wives, but was literally like, yeah, like, so I'm one of the only people on planet Earth that can make movies like I do. So I'm going to kind of focus on that and not our marriage. Like, boy, that was literally his justification for ending a marriage.
Well, Catherine Bigelow went on to steal an Oscar, or not steal. I mean, she justifiably won an Oscar that he was nominated for. So that must have hurt
yeah.
a little bit. Got to say booyah to that.
She's got a couple of movies on our list.
Yeah, she's killer. Within the nerd movie people, which I throw you guys both into the stinking soup of.
Stop hurting my feelings, John.
Is Cameron regarded as like a guilty pleasure, or is he regarded as a like a true auteur, or both, or what?
I would imagine you'd get very different answers from different people, but I think I almost am excited for Avatar 2 because I think he really shines in his sequels. Like this movie as a sequel to Alien, Terminator 2 as a sequel to Terminator, like taking the basics of a universe that has been established and like extrapolating out like what else is true if this set of things are true is one of the things he's great at. And I almost feel like that's like a little overdone in Avatar 1. So like maybe he's done and maybe it's just going to be a mess from now on. But I think his sequels have been great, and I think a lot of his movies are awesome.
People have almost totally forgotten about the first Abyss movie, which was just called Abyss? Before being followed by his definitive The Abyss sequel.
Abysses. Abyssi.
The third movie was abysmal, though.
Oh, no.
Oh. Come on.
Okay.
Adam just cringed at his own pun.
Everything in me tightened up after saying that.
If this is the caliber of this podcast, I'm going to be the sad one.
You're going to love this.
Every podcast episode has a rating scale custom made to the film that we've seen. This film is no different. For the film Aliens, I am assigning a 5-item scale based on one superior item. You don't often get great product placement in science fiction, guys. And often you'll see it is cloying, like in the form of the Budweiser classic in the J.J. Abrams Star Trek film, especially when they attempt to project modern brands into the future. But one brand makes it into the Aliens universe and is fairly obscure throughout. Like, they don't give it a ton of screen time. They don't give it a lot of compositions where it's not covered up by something else in the foreground. Of course, I'm talking about Ripley's Reebok shoes. One of those shoes was ripped from her foot as the alien queen was being sucked out of the airlock. It's a shoe that saved her life. And for the film's ability to develop its ensemble cast, which is one of my favorite things about it, the way that it depicts a lot of emotions, like not just bravery in the military sense, but like fear in the horror sense and even comedy, for its relentless pace of storytelling, I think Aliens is not just a great war film or a great sci-fi film or a great horror film. It is a great film, period. It's one of my favorite films of all time. It deserves 5 Reebok shoes. So that's 2 pairs of shoes and then an extra shoe to complete the 5.
One that went out the airlock?
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Same. I think this is a 5 Reebok film for me as well. I just looked up, can you buy those Reeboks online? And I'm seeing them for like $750 on eBay.
Reebok famously released them a couple years ago, only in men's sizes. And the outrage about that was pronounced. Yeah, the Alien Stomper High is what they're called.
Dumb move, Reebok. Reebok gets 0 shoes, but Aliens gets 5.
That was Burke's decision as the marketing exec of that project.
I think as a war movie, this... it works at a lot of, as we've discussed, like all the different war movie set pieces that we see kind of done in a different, novel and cool, exciting way in this. So it does pass muster as a war movie, and I like it a lot. I am not a horror movie fan. And that's just, it's not that I don't appreciate them as works of art. I just don't like being surprised by spiders, you know, coming out of trapdoors. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't like turning a corner and Jason is standing there with a knife. I don't like that tension. It feels a lot of times cheap and corny, like you're putting a child in jeopardy, but it's just like, oh, don't go, you know, don't go in there. Like any kind of movie where you can imagine an audience saying like, oh, why would you go outside? You know, it's coming from inside the house. All those tropes I don't like. And so there are moments in this movie where there's just a little too much of that for me. The like, boo stuff.
Accompanied by like the orchestral sting to go with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Where what we don't see in war movies is a lot of that. There's a lot of tension in this movie that does feel like they're fighting the Viet Cong, an unseen enemy that seems to be all around them. But what the Viet Cong never does in a war movie is go boo.
Do you think war deserves a horror movie technique in order to make it seem scarier in a film?
No, the opposite. I feel like for instance, the perimeter guns, for most of that scene, we don't see the enemy getting killed at all. All we see is the bullets running down the counter.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see the gore. It's all left to our imagination. And at first you're like, are those guns malfunctioning? But then you realize, no, they're every one of those bullets is finding a home. They just keep coming. And that's very effective sort of war movie stuff. It's unusual because it's not, you know, that's not a Saving Private Ryan thing, but it's like, it's not this like the thing drops down out of the heating vent type of thing. So I'm going to give it 4 Reeboks because it's so good at so many levels, but I don't need the boo. And I don't think the film needed it either, except that it's just irresistible, you know, it's just irresistible to put those shots in there. And there are a million worse movies about that, but that little bit of that element in this is like, meh. That's maybe not a fault of the film. I'm sure there are people already, they have their pencils out, they're scribbling on their notebook paper. John Roderick doesn't understand science fiction. And that's fine. Start your own podcast.
It's really great to hear the esteem that you hold for our fans. John.
No, only the fans that are writing me on notebook paper. Those are the only ones I'm contemptuous. I think our fans are like, in a lot of cases, the smartest podcast fans I've ever seen.
Oh wow!
Right, just turn the corner into straight pandering, like full on raw meat pandering.
I would tend to agree with that though. Like we get the occasional, you know, concern troll or just jerk or whatever, but like, a lot of the time, like the online discussion about these shows only adds to my understanding of the movie we watched. And that's like really cool. I mean, I'm surprised that any of these smarty pantses are getting anything out of listening to three yo-yos like us.
Totes.
Well, that's great. That's just fucking great, man.
Well, with all of our ordnance being expended, do we have a guy?
I have a guy.
I was hoping John would keep the floor and just keep talking.
Oh, no. I want you to tell your guy.
You say your little guy, John.
I'm sorry. I'm going to be last guy.
John's guy is the viewer of the show.
My guy is Bishop. I felt his pain in like trying to earn Ripley's respect throughout the film. Like he really wants to. Like he is also sympathetic to terrifying experience she had previously with synthetics, or what's his preferred terminology?
I prefer the term artificial person myself.
I think the thing that made me really identify with him was that long crawl through the oil pipe out to the colony transmitter, because that's kind of how it feels making a podcast with you guys. Just feels like I'm crammed in a pipe and I'm crawling on my belly until I get to that transmitter.
That scene has one of my favorite pieces of nonverbal acting, when they give him the pistol and he looks at the pistol like, what the fuck am I supposed to do with this? And then hands it back before they seal him in.
That's pretty great.
The way he holds it is like, yeah. I've never touched one of these before. It's fucking
great. Yeah.
So for that reason, Bishop is my guy.
I would think that Bishop would be your guy because you also have mayonnaise for blood.
Well, that's just because I eat so much mayonnaise.
How terrific was that scene where he's ripped in twain?
That was pretty awesome.
Adam, who's your guy?
I don't prefer to choose the star of the film as my guy at any point, but there are things about Ripley that I really admire and see some similarities in myself in. I think mostly it's that she reserves her fear for when she's in solitude, like her display of being fearful, and like makes herself a stoic when she's out in public, even though she's very not okay to be on LV-426. She is very terrified to go back into the base. Like, she manages to hold it together for most of the film outside of losing it on Gorman.
Well, and you guys both also look great in a tank top and underpants matching set.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's part of it. And when she loses it on Gorman, that's mostly like impatience with incompetence. And that is a thing that, like, as I get closer to 40, I am finding more and more is a thing for me. Like, I'm growing more and more impatient with people. I have flights of anger about how impatient I am with incompetence. So I don't know. Those are things that I particularly resonate with Ripley about. So she is my guy.
So you're saying that she's an angry white man?
Yeah, yeah.
Angry middle-aged white man?
How can I twist Ripley into my worldview?
You know, what's great about Ripley is that she confirms all of my biases.
Now, Rob, we're going to have John say his guy now, but make sure to edit it in before us.
No. No. It's intrinsic to my guy that it be last. My guy is Ripley's cat, who stays behind. The only sensible move of any character in this whole film. The cat does not go back out into space. The cat somehow managed to chill out on the space station through all the events of this film, which is where I would have been too. Curled up on Ripley's bed, just like, no reason to go back out there. Whatever they were tantalizing Ripley with, like reinstatement. It's like, screw you. Send me back to Earth. I'll work on a farm.
This might have been in a film set far into the future about terrifying aliens and science fiction weaponry. Might have been the biggest leap that you had to take as a viewer, because I, having married a woman with a very close relationship with her cat, would never believe Ripley to leave a cat behind. This cat is like her only tie to her previous life and her humanity. Like, the cat is the only thing familiar to her. I don't believe that she would have left it behind. Jonesy should have come.
It was a strange moment for sure when she was like, you're going to stay here. It was like, why? Of all the things that need to be protected,
yeah,
is the cat what you're protecting? But then I was like, that's me, bro, in a nutshell.
Yeah, why protect John is a question that Ben and I ask ourselves all the time.
I know, you're like, in the ship, you're coming with. I'm like, oh.
Yeah. Okay, guys, it's that time of the show where we pick the next film.
We can't do a sci-fi film, right? Like, we've done too many in a row.
We could do one more. It's three in a row would be the where it triggers separating those out. Which would be much trickier than separating out World War II films, because they're not all about the same war.
Fair enough.
But we have a big long list of the 161 titles on it. John, do you want to throw out a number?
Let's do 45.
45. Back in the warm embrace of World War II, the 1970 film directed by Brian G. Hutton, Kelly's Heroes.
Interesting.
John, you put this one on the list.
I did, yeah. Kelly's Heroes. Quite a bit closer to, I think, the kind of movie that we thought we were going to be watching. I know I say that every time.
I mean, it's got Telly Savalas and Clint Eastwood.
It literally has Don Rickles in it.
Oh, man.
Yes.
It is not going to be hard to find our Rickles in this movie.
That's great.
It also has Donald Sutherland, Harry Dean Stanton.
Oh, man.
And Captain Steubing of the Love Boat, Gavin MacLeod.
Does anyone avenge Harry Dean Stanton in this film? Because you're contractually obligated to avenge him, right?
Avenge me!
It was nice to see a little glimpse of him up on the screen in today's movie.
Yeah, that was. He flashed by. But this is very similar. Kelly's Heroes is very similar to Three Kings. It's a little bit of a prequel to Three Kings. Similar sort of background. So I think we're gonna enjoy it a lot.
You could say Hudson was the Rickles of aliens. Also, this film had a Rickles.
Yeah.
Oh, there. I did have one problem. I've never been a huge Bill Paxton fan.
Why not?
Even in HBO's spectacular Big Love television show, I was always like, that guy. But his line readings in this movie,
he is always talking in this voice that's like really, oh my God. I was just like, come on, stop it.
Game over, John. Game over.
I know this is his character, but...
you're now in some real pretty shit with me, John.
You're gonna die on the field of Bill Paxton?
Yeah.
I've heard you say
Paxton.
A lot of offensive shit, John, but yeah. None were more offensive than that.
Yeah.
Okay, this is a generation.
Take your fucking hot take and shove it up your ass.
You secure that shit, right. John.
All right, I'll take that. I'll take it back. I'm sorry.
John,
I'm
get
sorry,
over Rose. Here. Get over here. Get over here.
Hey, John, look into my eye.
Oh, man. When he fucking pops out of the cryopod and he's got the stogie, like, ready to go and he's just fucking chewing on that thing. Oh, so good.
Pretty good. Pretty good.
So fucking great. That is the end of our show. Next week, Kelly's Heroes. In the meantime, for John Roderick and Adam Pranica, I've been Ben Harrison. To the victor, go the spoiler alerts.
Friendly Fire is a Maximum Fun podcast. It's hosted by Adam Pranica, Benjamin R. Harrison, and John Roderick. This show is edited and produced by me, Rob Schulte. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you can visit MaximumFun.org/donate. Our theme music is War by Edwin Starr, courtesy of Stone Agate Music. And our podcast art is by Nick Dittmer. Do you feel like joining in the conversation? Well, you can. Over at Facebook and Reddit, we've got pages there that you can talk to a whole bunch of other fans. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR, Adam is at CutForTime, John is at John Roderick, and I'm at Rob K. Schulte. Please use the hashtag FriendlyFire when you tweet. Thanks. We'll see you next week. Listen to me.
Friend only, the Undertaker. MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture. Artist owned.
Listener supported.